Hi.
Hi. So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode 111, Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus.
In life, discoveries usually lead to more questions. The only constant variable is the unexpected. We can't control it. It's only when you look backwards that you see how it was all connected. Let's begin, shall we?
That's perfect.
I like to cook. It's just chemistry.
You're on the verge of a major scientific breakthrough.
This institution has a reputation based on the world-class scientists, not the theories of a pretty lab tech.
We have rules.
You're firing me.
Just stop your crying, it's a sign of the times.
I would like to offer you a job as the host of our cooking show.
Are you concussed?
No. You are poised to become a TV star.
Welcome to the final show.
We're live in 5, 4, 3.
Welcome, viewers. This is Supper at 6. Do I need a catchphrase?
Don't overthink it.
Never understood what that meant.
I stand proudly with the overlooked workhorse of the kitchen, women, and baked potatoes.
What the?
Just stop your crying of the time.
You've got something almost no one has.
Breaking through the atmosphere.
The platform. What you say matters.
Politics don't belong in the kitchen. A man wants his wife to make him a drink after a long day at work.
Why do you assume that his day was longer than hers? Why don't you make the drink?
You are what I treasure most in this world. Not because you are pretty, not because you are smart, but because you love me and I love you.
We got to.
If you do it, you think you can't do it, and you do it anyway. Your ability to change everything starts here. Children's at the table. Your mother needs a moment to herself.
Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, podcast brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each month we take a thorough look at one piece of literature that we've both read and determine whether it is required reading. So I am here with a pencil in my hair, ready to conduct some wonderful things with beakers and chemicals, and I've got my lab assistant with me. It's Tom Panarese.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing okay. Are you ready for this big snowstorm?
Yeah. We'll be behind the curtain. We're podcasting on a Saturday morning, and we're supposed to get what, like between a foot and a foot and a half of snow starting this evening. So,
yep. We'll see what happens. States of emergency have been declared.
Yep.
So, for Virginia as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. So we And I think the governor of Texas fled. So
no, it was Ted Cruz.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of like when Waffle Houses close. If Ted Cruz flees Texas, the storm's really bad.
Uh-oh. Okay, good to know. Yeah, I got an email from my gym saying that they were closing at 9 p.m. tonight. So that's also serious because it's Planet Fitness and they're open.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a big deal. But yeah, just to say that, you know, snowpocalypse is on the way, but here we are and we're hopefully talking about a book that we both loved.
Mm-hmm.
So we're doing Lessons in Chemistry. What is your history with this book?
This is the first time I've ever read it. I'd heard of it in the way that you kind of like hear about books or you see them on the table at Barnes & Noble when you walk in, you know, that sort of thing. And I just, for whatever reason, just was never on my radar. And then about maybe a year ago, I was headed off to the Friends of the Library sale here, and I had texted my sister and said, I'm going to the library sale. Give me a list of books because they're really cheap. And so she was like, you know, much like Stephen King, but this was one of the ones that was on it. And I found, like, out of all the books she sent me, I found like two or three. And so I bought the hardcover for $3. That's how cheap the books are at the sale. That's why I love going. And I sent it to her and then she loved it. Then you picked it and I actually texted her right after our last recording. And I said, you know, would you mind lending that to me? So she brought it with her when she came to visit us around Christmas. So I have her copy, which I will be sending back.
Okay, because, we'll see. Yeah, we know that's a big, but yeah, so, big issue so basically, with Hispanorisas.
Yeah, so basically it's kind of like an interesting history of how I acquired the book. But this is the first time I've ever read it. And I had heard of the, or I did notice on one of the, whatever streaming services it is, and I want to say it was Hulu, which I no longer have. Apple. It's Apple. Okay. So I might watch the show with Brie Larson, who I really like, and who was the scourge of the incel fanboy. But
as much love as we can give Brie Larson, because definitely there are definitely people. Kelly Marie Tran is another one, just like that got this weird unnecessary hate is just I enjoyed the show, so definitely recommend it.
The sad thing about Kelly Marie Tran was like clocked at the moment I saw her in The Last Jedi. And it sucks because I was like, this is the person who's gonna get all of the incel hate.
Unfortunate.
Anyway, let's get on. Well, actually, that kind of ties into the book because it's a feminist character.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
But let's get back on topic.
Yeah, art. Well, I guess art and fiction reflecting true life. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So my history is I was in Barnes & Noble one day. Sometimes I guess I'm just a nonconformist. I shouldn't say that because I am. I don't need to phrase it like I think I'm just a nonconformist. I am a nonconformist, and I think sometimes it is healthy, and sometimes it's a bit too extreme. So I saw this. I saw a lot, like a wall of it. That this is the big pick, very popular. And typically, when I see that, I think, I don't know what it is, but usually it does actually, it turns out to be, well, actually, I really don't see why this was so popular. And I don't think it's me like psychologically leading me to have that. I think of Where the Crawdads Sing. I think
that's actually a book that flashed right into my mind when you're
talking. Yes,
I haven't read that yet though, so I can't
everyone
really.
Everyone loves that. It's super popular. So I was like, let me give this a go. I picked it up and I thought, I don't see it. So I see all of this. I remember being with my mom. I did go over to it because I don't know what cover you have, but I have the salmon cover. I would say very minimalist.
Yeah.
And then the face is made out of shapes. I feel like it's a very striking cover. And so I was kind of interested in it, but this was before the smut happened. Okay. So basically I thought that's probably just romance and that's not really for me. And mom was there. She's like, you want me to get that? I'm like, no. But I decided to get it from the library and give it a go. And I fell in love with Elizabeth, fell in love with the other characters immediately. Loved the story, found it powerful in many different ways. And it was, my favorite of that year. I'm pretty sure it was 2024. And then, I was excited for the television show. Obviously, when you have such a love for the source material, you're a little nervous about it. But I did like Brie Larson as Elizabeth. And I thought for, the format that they had, that they stayed pretty true to the story. So I was happy to bring this up. This is our February, our romance and our Valentine's Day episode, and I think friends and family is very much a theme which we'll talk about, but I think there's so much love in this as well, and all types of love, platonic and family and erotic love, that I felt like it was a good representation and a good pick for February, and I was happy to read it again.
Cool. I love the side eye She is doing it. It's true. That's the thing, because the cover is great. It is very minimalist, but like the thing that like really stands out is how she's looking to the side, and that's what like catches my eye. No pun intended. All the time.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, I will do some history. 2022 is the when it was published. Yeah, so I was a bit off. I have to think about when. I remember it was on my best of list from BTO, but that makes sense because, you know, the smut, that whole wave of destruction that attacked me.
It's
that
like a tsunami.
Yes, it really
tsunami
was.
Tsunami of porn.
Oh my gosh. Very sad. Very sad. So Garmus told People magazine that she wrote Lessons in Chemistry after her previous novel was rejected by 98 publishers because it was quote unquote too long, which is nuts because there are definitely really long novels out right now that are like romanticy and fantasy and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. The book was originally called Introduction to Chemistry, but was later renamed by the author's agent, Felicity Blunt. It was published a few days before the author turned 65 in 2022, which is an interesting fact to include here on Wikipedia. The book was inspired by Garmus's experience as a creative director in an advertising agency, in particular after a frustrating meeting where a male coworker took credit for one of her ideas. While writing Lessons in Chemistry, Garmus was a full-time copywriter, but taught herself some school-level chemistry, attempting experiments from the Golden Book of Chemistry Experiments. She said in an interview with the Los Angeles Times, the fire department had to come twice for the amount of flames in my flat. She also adapted her own interest in rowing as a hobby of the protagonist's thought, as well as Calvin. Aside from rowing, Garmus said that she does not share other commonalities with Zot, but has instead written her role model. So just to give you some thoughts about that. It was named Barnes & Noble's Book of the Year in 2022. In 2023, it was the most borrowed book from several public libraries, and it was also one of the most borrowed titles for 2024. Stephanie Merritt of The Guardian praised the author's ability in creating a richly comic novel around a character who is entirely deadpan and called the book a polished, funny, thought-provoking story, wearing its research lightly but confidently and with sentences so stylishly turned it's hard to believe it's a debut, but holding a few flaws common in debut novels, including an unfocused narrative perspective, which we'll talk about. Karen Heller, writing for the Washington Post, called the book an indelible assemblage of stubborn, idiosyncratic characters, and that there was an infectious absurdity to the book and its protagonist. In an article for the New York Times, Elizabeth Egan called the book irresistible, satisfying, and full of fuel, and added that feminism is the catalyst of the book. Michael Byers from Cascadia Daily News wrote that the heroine is brave, original, and completely unafraid. As was mentioned, the rights for the book were purchased by Apple TV, and that debuted on October 13th, 2023. Garmus said that she gave minimal input to the script, writing and production of the TV adaptation. Of Garmus herself, she's from Seattle. She received her bachelor's degree in creative writing / aesthetic studies from University of California, Santa Cruz. She's worked as a copywriter and creative director in the U.S. and has lived in Switzerland and Colombia, but she currently resides in the U.K. That's the word flat that we saw earlier or heard earlier. Yeah, among the prizes that she has won are British Book Awards Author of the Year in 2023, Waterstones Author of the Year 2022, the Paul Torde Memorial Prize for a first novel by an author over 60, and Forbes Magazine's 50 Over 50 Europe, Middle East, and Africa 2024. The book was shortlisted for the 2023 RSL Christopher Bland Prize. And as we now know, Garmus enjoys open water swimming and has rowed competitively. And for some reason, we also get this information about her husband, which I found ironic, if only because there's this whole discourse about why are women in this particular time period, the 50s and 60s, named because, well, it still really does happen, I would say, named if they're married by their husband's name.
Yeah, they refer to them as Mrs. Husband's name. Yeah,
Mrs. Tom Panarese.
Yeah.
In September 2024, Garmus's husband, David Erb, was a Jeopardy contestant and went on to become a 3-time Jeopardy champion.
Oh.
So I think intelligence runs in the family, but it was interesting little fact there. Okay, anything to add before I get to my plot synopsis?
I have one more review, and you've seen this. When I was flipping through when I was reading the book, I got about maybe like halfway, two-thirds of the way, and a bookmark was in there
Oh,
from
yes.
the Bluebird Bookshop of Crozet, Virginia. And I do love the bookmark because it looks like one of those old school like loan cards that you'd find in the back of a book at a library of a library books, like date due and all that, and the borrower's name. So whoever had originally purchased this and given it to somebody says, "Dear Louise, I think you will love this. It's a feminist character-driven book with so much heart. I laughed, I cried, I couldn't put it down. I hope you love it. Flannery." I thought that was very sweet. It's also the handwriting's beautiful. but so I wanted to include that because I found that I sent you the picture. We were both like, that is adorable in a sense. So I'm going to keep it in the book for, and because I'm sure my sister saw it too. So I'm just going to keep that in the book. And wherever it goes, this will be part of the book.
Yes, I loved that when you sent that to me. I thought it was lovely and just I had a brief vision because I think it's odd to think too much about strangers, but I had a brief vision of, this friendship and, the history and everything and just thought that that was lovely. Yeah. Okay, well, here we go. In 1961, Elizabeth Zott prepares her daughter Mad's school lunch before leaving to present her wildly popular TV show, Supper at Six. It's a job she took under some protest, and it was the unexpected consequence of confronting the executive, Walter Pine, at the station KCTV over his daughter eating all of Mad's lunches. Impressed by Elizabeth, who is young, beautiful, and very assertive, Walter quickly offers her a regular role as a TV host. Elizabeth needs a steady paycheck, so she reluctantly accepts. A flashback to 1952 shows Elizabeth in her career as a chemist at Hastings Research Institute in Commons, California. She's there working on abiogenesis, having left UCLA's doctoral program before getting her PhD. She was compelled to quit the program when her supervisor, Dr. Myers, cornered and raped her, and she defended herself by stabbing him with a pencil. At Hastings, she's treated as a second-class citizen and rarely appropriately credited for her work. She meets renowned chemist Calvin Evans, who initially mistakes her for a secretary when she bursts into his well-supplied lab in search of beakers. Despite a rocky start, in which they initially try to be platonic colleagues, they develop a research partnership and quickly fall deeply in love. Calvin and Elizabeth do their best to navigate the unfriendly and toxic work environment at Hastings, where their relationship places them both under intense scrutiny. Elizabeth cooks for Calvin and herself every day, using her chemical expertise and patience to repeat experiments to perfect her dishes. Calvin proposes, but Elizabeth refuses to marry him, as she doesn't want to sacrifice her career by taking his name. She finds and adopts a stray dog, whom she names 630, and she and Calvin take up rowing together. Everything seems to be going well until Calvin dies suddenly in an accident. I would say it's a freak accident. To give some details, there's a leash law, and Elizabeth wanted 630 to follow that law, but 630 was a former bomb dog and he failed that training. He was, I think, honorably discharged because he got spooked by loud noises and Calvin went on a run during a storm. There's a leash attached and 630 gets spooked by maybe lightning or thunder. I can't remember. Some sort of loud crash and pulls him and Calvin gets struck by a car. So that's the whole thing. So 630 feels a lot of guilt over this. And Elizabeth also feels constant guilt from this because of making him 630 wear the leash, making Calvin use him to. So there you go. Elizabeth, who discovers she's pregnant shortly after he passes away, faces even worse treatment at work and is eventually fired. Unable to go back to Hastings, she turns her kitchen into a lab, continuing her abiogenesis research while consulting and copy editing for former Hastings colleagues. She gives birth to her daughter, whom she christens Mad Zot, but tells people her name is Madeline. With help from her kind neighbor, Harriet Sloan, and support from her obstetrician and rowing coach Dr. Mason, Elizabeth tries to balance raising a baby, making enough to keep the lights on, and performing and publishing her research. She returns to Hastings, but Dr. Donati refuses to give her either the research she and Calvin worked on together or access to her own lab. She's forced to do menial work as a lab tech. After a nasty confrontation, the usually hostile office manager Frask reveals that she was also sexually assaulted and prevented from finishing a PhD. Frask has been fired for gaining weight, but before she leaves, she passes on Calvin's files to Elizabeth. When Elizabeth discovers that Donati has been plagiarizing her work, as have several of her other male colleagues, she quits Hastings, she believes, for good. The narrative then returns to 1961, where Walter Pine offers her the job presenting a cooking show, and she quickly accepts. Phil Lebensmal, Walter Pine's superior at KCTV, insists that Elizabeth's frank attitude be reined in on live TV. He wants her and supper at six to be light, fluffy, and sexy. Elizabeth disagrees. She dismisses every tight and revealing wardrobe choice, refuses to read any of the cue cards Walter writes, and describes her cooking processes with a sharp, matter-of-fact, scientific demeanor that the studio executives hate. Despite Lebensmal's anger, the show quickly becomes immensely popular, especially among housewives who appreciate Elizabeth's intelligent and unpatronizing approach. Meanwhile, Harriet Sloan, Elizabeth's friendly but lonely neighbor, has been looking after Mad while Elizabeth works. One day, Harriet lets some information slip about Calvin when Mad is working on a family tree project for school. Mad's pursuit of more information about her dad leads her to Reverend Wakely, a longtime pen pal of her father's. He assists her in investigating the orphanage where Calvin was raised. During Wakely's inquiries, the dishonest bishop who runs the home unwittingly discloses that Calvin's parents were involved in Calvin's upbringing. The Parker Foundation is a foundation with lots of money to donate to worthy causes, and unbeknownst to Calvin is a family connection through his mother. The priest lied to the representative of Calvin's family, who came to the boy's home when he was young, correctly guessing that the grieving family would donate money to All Saints in his name. On air, Elizabeth offends a sponsor by calling their product trash and refusing to use them, which was soup. This prompts Lebensmal to summon her, and when she's alone in his office, he aggressively fires her and then tries to sexually assault her. She responds by pulling out her chef's knife from her handbag, which shocks him so much he has a heart attack. She discovers that he's been hiding sponsorship offers and advertising deals for the show. And while Lebensmal recovers in hospital, Walter Pine is promptly instated as his replacement. Elizabeth gets an offer from Life magazine for an interview. She's initially uninterested, but Harriet and Walter convince her to take them up on it. She shares her entire backstory, including her sexual assault and her feelings about Calvin's death, with a very surprised reporter named Franklin Roth. He writes an article highlighting her scientific work. However, the piece gets distorted before publication. Elizabeth's physical attributes and charm totally eclipse her accomplishments after Roth's editor makes changes. She becomes extremely depressed, feeling useless and betrayed. Roth resigns from Life and tries to publish the truthful account elsewhere, leaving a copy of the original article at Elizabeth's house, where Mad finds it. She gives it to Frask, now a typist for Reverend Wakely. Frask, infuriated by what Life left out, publicly denounces the misleading article. Roth's original is then picked up and published by Vogue. Still hurt about the article's diminishment of her life's work, and after conferring with Wakely, Elizabeth decides to leave supper at six to pursue research in abiogenesis again. Although she has no job offers when she begins looking, Frask eventually invites her back to Hastings. The Parker Foundation wants to hire her and knows about Donati's wrongdoings, including years of financial misdeeds and all of his plagiarism. Hastings promotes Frask and dismisses Donati, offering Elizabeth the head of chemistry position. Avery Parker, founder of the Parker Foundation, then comes forward and reveals that she is Calvin's biological mother. She had to give him up at birth because of family pressure, as she was unmarried. When Avery discovered the bishop's deceit about Calvin's death as a child, she tried to reconnect. Although she never met her son before he died in the accident, she wants to build a relationship with her granddaughter, Mad. The novel ends with Elizabeth warmly welcoming Avery, inviting her to come to supper at six at their house, and re-engaging with her chemistry research in her lab at Hastings. The end. Tom, what'd you think about Supper at Six, aka Lessons in Chemistry?
I really, really liked this book. It took a little while for me to get going, because I've just been reading too many fast-paced novels, and it's not a slow novel. It's just like a regularly paced novel. That being said, I loved the kind of flip back and forth omniscient perspective of the book, where Garmus was just giving us like a third person, but was through a lot of different people's points of view, even the dogs, which I thought was charming as heck. I loved how realistic she kept it. as opposed to being making it some sort of like fantasy, not in the sword and sorcery sort of way, sort of like a wish fulfillment fantasy. I could picture this happening exactly the way it happens, because there are stories like this where successful women were undermined by men back in those days. And a lot of times left with just about nothing because of how the men manipulated the situation that they were in. And I was so glad that she came out winning at the end.
Yeah.
And that there was, you know, there's a lot in there that, and her friends too, like Harriet and the people around her, like there was real growth in the people around her. And I felt like I walked away feeling very, very happy for like every character involved. And it was such a great, great book. I totally recommend it.
Yes. Yeah. Same here. I love this. This is one of the few books that I give 5 stars. 5 stars are very hard to get for me. As I said, it was the favorite of a year. Can't remember what year it was, but you know, it's a great novel to read. It's something that when I moved to Baltimore and I was waiting to purchase novels, this was one of the ones that I got once I moved and settled. I'm like, okay, time to get those novels that I was waiting so I didn't have extra weight to pack up. I love Elizabeth Zott as a character. I feel for her. Definitely. I mean, this is, you know, why I love Barbara Gordon, you know, someone who is underestimated and is able to triumph over, well, the men, to be honest, but also just being, having the odds stacked against her, or the times or the status quo stacked against her. And I really appreciate that. And we'll talk about shifting perspectives, but I too like that, getting to see what other people, you know, are thinking. And through that, you get developed. I think no one's as developed perhaps as Elizabeth, quite rightly, but these are not just like side characters that pop in and pop out. I think she has this great cast of characters along with her, and villains that you really despise. I mean, you know, I think about Alias, because we both know that. And I think we loved to hate Sloane. And Donati is definitely that person for me. I was just like waiting for his downfall.
Yeah.
So, and the love affair is believable, and how I think she's a great mother. You know, some people might disagree on that, but just how much love and care she shows her daughter with those little notes she gives during lunch. Very beautiful. So yes, I also highly recommend this book.
I think it shows the difficulty too of, and I know nothing from single motherhood or the 1960s, but it shows how difficult that must have been in a way that seems very realistic. Like, you know, how she's struggling to make ends meet. She is relying on friends, but you know, she doesn't have her husband. But she was never intending to be a housewife. You know, just there's a lot. It is very, very complicated, and Garmisch doesn't shy away from that.
Absolutely. Just thinking about the house situation, because she tried to do, was it a reverse mortgage on it, but couldn't, you know, because it was in his name. Women weren't allowed to have their own credit cards until the 70s, it's like
74,
So, you know, the way that she's making money is because of these colleagues, you know, coming in and asking her questions. And unfortunately, you know, she's doing the bulk of the work, and they're getting the credit, which I think still happens now. And of course, you know, Harriet, I think, had this presumption of the, you know, there's a revolving door of men and money is being exchanged.
Yeah.
One would think, right? Yeah, it's a nuts time period. So yeah, single mother in that time, much more, I think the odds were very much stacked against her, more so than now to a certain extent. Yeah.
It's like she's Betty Draper's feminist sister.
Yeah.
You know, because like the only context I really have in many ways is Mad Men, but Betty Draper was a debutante and a model. You know, she was the complete opposite of, even though by the end of that series, you saw her gain a lot of agency, and she was a lot way more developed than she had been at the very, very beginning. But yeah, this is kind of like, she's the Cat Stratford to her Bianca, you know?
There is, that was a 10 things I hated about your reference for anyone who didn't get that. I'm just mixing up
my references here.
Well, I've understood all of them so far, but just so we don't lose our people. So I would say that this is a witty novel. I think that it is funny, but also some really hard things happen. And there are some pretty grave situations. How well does Garmus balance the humor and the gravity? Do you think that the humor, whether deadpan or straightforward, was ever inappropriate at any time?
I think it balances it really, really well. I can't think of a moment where I thought it was out of, the humor was out of place or anything. I liked the dry humor in a lot of cases. I liked the deadpanness of Elizabeth Zott. I thought there was some humor found in 630 as well. And of course, in Mad, especially with the teacher and all that, it was, but at the same time, the moments of pathos were very well placed and very well described and didn't seem to come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And I thought that, I thought it was very, very well done.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, not to make this a show about references, but I think there's all, well, we talked about Aristotle and the golden mean, and you know, there's this balance between deficiency and excess. And when I think of like too much humor that is inappropriate, I go to Thor, Love and Thunder.
Yes.
Because, which is arguably, I think, a bad film, but we've got this like serious subplot of Jane having cancer and becoming Lady Thor, like draining her. And we've got this laughing goat that like, or whatever it was doing, you know, just popping. It's just like, where are we here? It's tone deaf. So I would say like that's excess. But you're right here that I think we have these serious moments. And then Garmus, I think, lets off the gas and coasts a little, you know, and shows something, either, I don't know, a straightforward comment that could be received in either fashion, or something that is rather humorous, because of the whole situation. And I think it is balanced really well. And I don't think I agree. I don't think I read anything. I thought, wow, I know you're trying to be funny, but it didn't land. So anything I think is great. I just, the discussions between people, I think it's really well done. I cannot speak highly enough for how smart I think that this novel is written. And everyone has their own particular voice. Even some of these side characters that just pop in for a brief vignette, you know, for supper at six.
Yeah.
Is quite funny. I think the first time that it airs, there's, you know, this little kid saying there's nothing on dot dot dot, you know, and the mom having a retort. So even those people get a personality, and I don't know that I've ever read a novel like that, where even these short, where you're never going to see that person again, but they made a lasting impact with how they were presented on page.
Yeah, and with that, credit to her editor or whoever who left that in, because I can imagine we don't tend to get that because some people are pandering to the audience with very little attention span. They would say, well, this is taking me out of the book. Why do I care about this character? But like showing that woman, she's like a housewife in California and she's, her kids are sitting in front of the TV and et cetera, is a way to highlight Elizabeth, right? So, and it's done, it's not a very long scene too, and I'm like, little scenes like that are brilliant. We don't, sometimes you don't get those as much because it's, it is sometimes dismissed as not relevant to the thing. In a television show, like I said, I haven't seen this, but a TV show or movie, you'd have that scene, but you wouldn't have any, you would simply have the kids in front of the TV, the harried mom, she'd walk over, she'd see the TV screen. And we'd kind of get that look of recognition. We'd cut back to Elizabeth. So we wouldn't get a backstory beyond like what's in front of us. And Garmus gives just enough of that backstory for us to like, it really hits home the impact of what is already starting to happen. And I'm glad that Garmus wrote that in there. I'm glad her editor was smart enough to see like, oh, that's a really important moment in the book. And giving that woman, because it's also like this feminist book about women having agency. So giving the woman a name and giving the woman a, just enough of a backstory to be a whole person is so central to the theme of the book too. So I'm glad that was left in.
Absolutely. And even the audience member, that's some of the funniest stuff is when she's quote unquote working the audience.
Yeah.
And, you know, the religious one, I mean, because that has a lasting effect. And then the first woman, I think, that spoke and she was talking about some sort of health situation, whether it might have been edema or something like that.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth recognized right away, are you a medical professional? You should go back to school. And then I think at the very end, it looped back around and said, you know, this person passed her MCATs and was doing her first residency. So there's also very much like Chekhov's gun too. They're not just thrown in there. There's thought and they come back around.
And I want to say there's also at least one instance where the woman introduces herself as like Mrs. George, whatever. Yep. And she says, no, what's your name or something to that extent, which again, a little moment that is like so important.
Yeah. Do you agree with her editor, the 98 rejections, that this is too long of a novel?
Oh, this was the one that was rejected or?
I think, and then she had to shift. Well, it was originally called ...
Oh, okay. No. Okay. No, again, it's because it's only 300 something. It's not even 400 pages. The hardcover was 386. It's not that long of a novel. You know what it is, though? And I don't know if the editors were men or women, but it is that sort of like nobody's going to read a novel over so many pages kind of mentality that like, you know, again, that just kind of like, in the same way that like nobody's going to want to see a woman on a cooking show talk about science. They want you to be sexy. It's like, we want your novel to be quick because nobody has the attention span to read it. It's like, dude, if the novel's good, people will read it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like, you give it a chance. So I think I don't agree with the rejections. I mean, I could imagine maybe if the first draft was longer than this and it needed some fat trimmed, I get that. That's naturally part of revising and editing. But why do I have the feeling that some of the rejections were because, well, it's just too long because people don't have the attention spans anymore to read.
Yeah. Which you'll get, I think things have changed so swiftly in just such a short amount of time because of a lot of these romanticies and fantasy novels and Diana Galbin.
Galbin, you know,
those are long, you know, those are long novels. So people need to give more credit to other people.
Yeah, people need to give more credit to women for what they read. I mean, you know, they read a bunch of different stuff, but they read stuff that is like extensive and intricate and long. It's not all like Dreck published by Colleen Hoover. So
we've used this word deadpan. When I think deadpan, I think Tig Notaro, who's probably my favorite comic. But
Tig Notaro's really good.
I do wonder sometimes, as I was reading it this time, I think maybe last time, but more so this time, just because I have maybe a better understanding of what this means, having, you know, having certain students. Do you feel like she's deadpan, or do you feel like she might be on the spectrum?
I just think she's deadpan and she's a nerd.
Okay.
Like, she's a scientist, and it's just a different type of personality that in some people are very academic in the way they work and live and communicate. So they just don't have the, you know, they're not, and she's also a nonconformist.
Yeah.
So she doesn't have she probably actually has the social knowledge and picks up on things, but she just doesn't care. So I just think she's deadpan, and that's just her, you know. And I get it, but at the same time, I'm like, let's not put everybody who has just sort of a different way of communicating or acting or something on the spectrum, because that's actually discounting just the diversity of people's personalities.
The only book we've read with someone on the spectrum has been Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, which of course that's just one way of behaving. I mean, the way that she relates with people emotionally and how with her daughter and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you're right that it's she's just a scientist. Yeah. She knows how the world works because she's experienced the worst of it as well as the best of it. And
she's guarded in many ways too. And there's obvious reasons for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you feel like she goes through, does Roy Garmus make her go through too much trauma in this novel?
No, it's tough to see Calvin die and then learn like he literally had an engagement ring, like he was days away from actually proposing with a ring. It's the rape scene is very, very tough to read, and you know my feeling about those. But she gets her quote-unquote revenge later on when the network exec or executive producer tries to do it. And unfortunately, it's really realistic for that time. You know, the idea that men felt even more entitled to women and women's bodies and women's situations back in 1959 or 60 or 61, it all tracks. And like I said, her life becomes complicated because that's just because of the way society is. So I wish she would have gone through less, but I don't think it's too much.
Okay.
What about you?
Oh, yeah. And I will say, I think she saw the ring, but before.
Okay.
But she, because they had that whole discussion / argument about marriage.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot. And I think about, because I, you know, over the summer I watched Avatar The Last Airbender, didn't care for it, gave Korra a go. I was like, wow, this is really great. But also they make Korra go through so much that you wonder, oh my gosh, is it, why are you doing this to this character? Because, yeah, the sexual assault, how she's treated at the lab, Donati's lab, having her partner get killed and she feels like it is her fault, raising a child on her own, a potential second sexual assault didn't happen, but just being there. It is a lot for anyone, not to say that these things wouldn't happen, but I did wonder if it was potentially too much. But you are right that it is realistic of the times. Then I'm just wondering, as humans, who are we? Like, that this is something that could have happened is very concerning, that people would have, they protected the guy, the professor, over her. Everyone knew about Levin Small because of all those notes that he got in the hospital. And that's why Walter was saying, don't go there by yourself. But no one was, you know, getting rid of him and things like that. So I guess she's also, in all these traumatic moments, I think she's also shining a light on a lot of these behaviors that, yes, were happening back in the 50s and 60s, but are still happening today. I think the Me Too movement has helped bring more of a light to that. But yeah, there's sort of this eerie parallel, I think, with when this novel is set and then also reading it with these sort of modern lenses that we have on.
Mm-hmm.
The next one is talking about, you know, the 50s and the 60s and, you know, supposedly being a halcyon time in American history. But, you know, women, after the men returned home from World War II, when they were working, they took back those jobs, and then women were pushed into, you know, these mother or subservient roles. Why do we still have this idea that mostly women are doing housework and child raising? So this is, I guess, looking through our cultural lenses again. Can this instruct us on any of the reasons why, like, this is still what's happening now?
Allow me to step onto my soapbox.
Oh, okay. With your onion belt?
So the onion's on my belt. It's the patriarchy.
Okay.
It's trigger warning politics. It's Republican Heritage Foundation, MAGA, fake nostalgia, because they want to control women. They want what they perceived as a wonderful time, because their image of what was the 1950s and the early 1960s is what was on television. So it was Donna Reed and Leave It to Beaver and, like, the Housewives and things like that. Whereas, you know, the reality was much, much starker. Abuse was tolerated, condoned, and women had no recourse against it. Women were taking amphetamines for diets, being put on other, like, Valium and other drugs to basically be the subservient wife. There's a lot of the 50s and 60s that are just dark. And when it comes to the lives of women, and that's just white women, you get into women of color and they are working because they're still the subservient housekeeper for richer white families and things. You know, it's why the civil rights movement comes out of the 50s and into the 60s, because people were rebelling against, like, why are we still tolerating this situation? But yeah, it's not like this didn't exist, or didn't exist to the image that conservatives like to paint, because they want to establish that. And then eventually, and again, soapboxing, eventually they want The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah.
You know, and so this idealized version of something that didn't exist, in the same way that like people do this with the 80s too, where it's like this really cool era and awesome, and the Reagan years are lionized, and we forget that the man refused to say the word AIDS for years, and basically either ignored or maybe even kind of low-key encouraged like the crack epidemic. I mean, like the 80s were pretty awful decade for a lot of people too, and the same thing is for any time. But our pop culture distills things to certain images, and our nostalgia distills things to suit certain images, and that's pushed along by political movements. So it's not necessarily, now it is a time of great wealth in the country, you know, Truman ends like with a recession, and when Eisenhower does take over as president, things start to get really, really good in terms of the economic boom, which really lasts in through probably the late 60s into the early 70s. But that's an economic boom time, which again was way more helpful to white America too. So yeah, it's way more complicated than is projected by conservative political ideology, because conservatives don't like nuance. So thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
Yeah, I don't have too much to add to that. I would agree that there's a message or messaging mm-hmm. that goes around that, you know, we're living in this time without virtues. And so looking back and trying to regain whatever that is lost, and looking at different time periods, and, you know, this is potentially that time period where they feel like everyone fit into particular roles. And mm-hmm. so, yeah, I think it's also a misunderstanding about gender, and just assuming that certain gender comes with it certain roles.
Yeah.
And I think that might have been, you know, true at it, but we are beyond that now, where, you know, people can express their gender in different ways. And I think that they shouldn't be put into a particular box. And with this, they also just ignore, you know, what does this look like if we're going back in time? They don't really think about, well, that didn't really suit a lot of, you know, people were not mm-hmm. thriving in that way. But then I guess they just think that, well, you know, men will be men, and, you know, that's their right as sort of the bread makers to do whatever they want. So unfortunately, yeah, with that, with a return to that, there's often a lack of maybe empathy or, yeah, compassion.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is interesting how everyone's like, oh, this is so great. But, you know, who knows? And I don't want to reduce the role of what a housewife is or what a mother is, because there are people who choose to do that, and they get great joy from that. It's very fulfilling. And, you know, my mom was stay-at-home mom, very appreciative of that. But because that exists doesn't mean the other cannot also exist, where, you know, women have these roles too. And Elizabeth is an interesting person because she's doing both, right? You know, she is that mother and she's having a career as well.
Yeah. It's not the condemning of the stay-at-home mother or the housewife. It's condemning the fact that these people want to take the choice away from you, because you should be able to make that choice, right? Like, it's like, if you want to stay at home with your kids, you should be able to make that decision for yourself, as opposed to being shut out of the workplace because you're a woman. So,
yeah.
And I'm right. Like, there's a Martha Stewart aspect to her too, right? That she's like this very shrewd businesswoman in a sense, right? She knows exactly what she wants for the television show, and she's not going to back down about it. But the show is promoting a domestic task.
Yeah. And she shows that appreciation for them. Like, she definitely mm-hmm. does not look down on any of the women whose profession might be mother and wife, because especially that last line that she always says, that, you know, children set the table, your mother needs a minute.
Yeah.
And just the appreciation of that. And yeah, that they're not appreciated. You know, man comes home and says, what's for dinner? And like, not, can I help you? May I help you with dinner and all of that? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, she refuses, Elizabeth refuses to accept limits placed on her by society, and she insists that others should also be ignoring those limits. How do you see each of the characters in this novel ultimately rising to that challenge to ignore the limits that society places on them?
I see, like, Harriet's a great example because her husband's like a total piece of garbage, and she eventually like divorces him, and she actually gets involved with
Walter, yeah,
who himself had lost, is a widower, right? Or he's divorced. I can't remember.
She left him.
She left him.
So okay. I guess a divorce, yeah.
Yeah, so he's divorced. And so he's actually in an interesting situation too, because he's essentially a single father, you know, and he's raising a daughter.
Yeah.
And so that's an interesting situation, because I don't know from anything in the 1950s and 1960s stories of like single fathers raising young women, and he's trying to provide the best role model he can, and then he ends up with Harriet. And yeah. So I really like that he's rising to that particular challenge. And I think what I loved about it is that he and Elizabeth are legitimately like best friends, and there's no romantic relationship between the two of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, which is, in a lot of novels like this, they do fall in love, right? And I like the fact that Garmus left that out and actually had him fall in love with her friend. And I thought that was really, really good. So he's rising to the challenge that he is facing being a single father. Harriet is rising to the challenge of standing up for herself and getting past her husband. Elizabeth's obviously rising to a challenge. Mad, on her level, is being challenged by her teacher and those around her because of the fact that she is just like way too intelligent. She's precocious, right? But she's precocious in a charming way and way too intelligent for her own good. And her teacher's just like so frustrated with her, as she is with Walter's daughter too. I like the fact that they both keep going to the parent-teacher conferences because both of their kids are in trouble for various reasons. That's how they bond. But yeah, there's a lot of other, even the other, just the random women we were talking about, they rise to whatever challenges they face and face them really, really well. So I think that's really shown very well in the novel, for not just the women, but for a few of the men.
Did you mention that Walter, that's not his biological daughter?
No, I did not.
Okay. Well, I just wanted, no.
Yeah, it's his wife's daughter, and she left her with him. Right?
Yeah. I just think that I just wanted to mention that. That wasn't me trying to shame you. It was me mentioning that because I think that goes even farther to show how great a guy Walter is.
Yeah.
Because that really doesn't make any difference to him. That is his daughter. And I just think that, that's really beautiful. And it's really unfortunate because, he's having some tough times, right? And this gets into, I guess, gender roles, because, you know, someone would argue, I guess, that, well, see, you'd point to him and be like, well, see, men can't be because they don't have the biological thing. But it's just, he might not have had any practice. Maybe he left his wife to do it, which was the time. Mm-hmm. And then when she left, he had to figure out all of that, but he packed a bottle of whiskey or something by accident. Yeah. And so he's always in there. And then just like I said about the revolving door of scientists that come to see Elizabeth and people may be raising an eye over that. The teacher thinks that he might be untoward towards his daughter.
Mm.
So there's assumption that he might be a predator as a single man with the daughter. So there are a lot of assumptions there. With Harriet, I also love that. I think Walter just remarks upon Elizabeth's beauty just as a state of fact. And there's nothing there. Because I think he says that in his perspective, in one of his POVs, that Elizabeth's his best friend. I was like, oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah.
And he's never had a best friend before. With Harriet, I would also say the Catholicism. That was definitely a limit because she was not going. Did you mention this?
No, I did not, actually. Okay. I forgot about that.
Yeah, the limit placed on her by the church, you know, that you can't divorce. But it seemed like he wasn't a good dude, either just like ignoring her, but then it seems like he might also be physically abusive of her. We get little bits because she does not speak of it, because I think she just has, you know, a good idea of maybe what not to mention in front of Mad. With Mad, age being the limit, right? Mm-hmm. Because she was four and Elizabeth had to lie on the birth certificate to get her into school. Poor girl has to deal with a terrible teacher 2 days in a row. Isn't that the worst when you go to a class and you're like, well, at least I don't have this teacher again. And then you go back and you're signed up for their class again. Very unfortunate. I'm trying to think of who else. I mean, Elizabeth is, the obvious. You're right. Any of the housewives, I think, that Elizabeth speaks to through the tube and anyone in the audience. And I think also 630, which, seems silly to mention a dog, but he basically was deemed a failure. Yeah. Because he was unable to perform his duty as a bomb sniffer. And then he doesn't look attractive, it seems like, from outside parties. I know that Wakely, he's like, that's a handsome dog, which I think speaks well to his character and why 630 loves him. But 630 has such amazing protective instincts. You know, he walks Mad back from school. He's able to get that dynamite stick from that Russian spy, question mark. Someone who was definitely on the HUAC list. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah, it's basically, it's, to me, it reminded of the type of people who want to, who want to instigate or start violence in a peaceful protest or something, that they're kind of like, that sort of thing. And actually redeems 630 because he was a terrible bomb sniffer and he sniffed the bomb out.
Found it. Yeah. And he traveled like 6 miles or something, 6.5 miles, had to play, not really dead, but play exhaustion to get in there to protect Elizabeth. So I think that those, there were limits placed upon him in terms of attractiveness as well as a failure. And he was able to break that as well. So there's a lot of beautiful stuff happening here. I think that's a lesson for us as well, that, you have different limits, I think, that are placed on you, Tom, than I do, but just to not accept them, and to find our own capability and to exceed others' expectations, or not even worry about other people's expectations, and just set our own limits and figure out how to meet them and surpass them. Okay. Why does Elizabeth always wear a pencil in her hair? Do you think that this is a weapon, or is it a symbol of strength, or is it just a pencil?
Well, it becomes a weapon it was a weapon at one point, because she does stab her PhD advisor when he rapes her. I think it's a symbol of strength. It might also be a reminder for her. She's also a scientist, and the idea of a scientist with a pencil, that kind of academic image, because she's wearing a lab coat when she does the show too, I think, right? So there's kind of that image of it, but I think it's more symbolic than anything, really. And it's strength, it's intelligence, and it's very much her.
For sure. I think she's definitely utilitarian, as we see, and so having that might be something that it makes sense for the character, because she might need a pencil in order to write down. Mm-hmm. I think that it absolutely is a weapon. I think that the quote after the assault happened, the first assault, is she wished she had more pencils. And then I think it is a symbol or a reminder of, potentially what she has survived, as well, to always be cautious, which I think she very much learned from that. I don't think she was ever naive, but I think there was certainly a wake up call for that. And then having that knife at the ready, because she was super confident going into Lobismal's office. I think she was just, ready for anything, I think. Maybe all of the above, for sure.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on rowing in this novel? The question here is that it's a metaphor for how Elizabeth sees potentially a better society. No one person in the boat is more important than the other. Do you think there are other lessons to be learned from the placement of rowing in here, from Calvin teaching her continuing through her pregnancy, and then afterward her obstetrician, wanting her to come back? What other things can all of those scenes and rowing in general teach us and tell us in this novel?
Well, in the taste of the novel, like, it almost is also a metaphor for, like, her struggle, too. The fact that she's doing these things because they are hard. Because rowing is not easy. She makes an erg machine.
Yep.
like literally makes one in her house because they, and she was constantly doing that. And it's a really fulfilling workout, but it is, it works a lot of you, right? You know, and if you do the proper form of rowing, it requires a lot of discipline too, right? Because I have all of the experience of like literally one summer of rowing and I really enjoyed it. I just didn't have the money or the time to keep up with it because my friend had been on a rowing team and they had a rowing club, blah, blah, blah. But I had been out on a river in the singles. I think they call them like skulls or something. And the form of rowing is like very specific. Like you use certain muscles in certain order, you know, to so that you're doing everything correctly. And you have to do it and you have to do it like ambidextrously. Like one, you cannot favor one hand over the other. So it requires a lot of discipline to do correctly. And even on the erg, you have to do that because that way when you work out, you're not messing up one of the muscle groups because you're doing the correct form. So it shows that sort of discipline that she was going to need to do what she needed to succeed in chemistry, which is also really precise, right? As can be baking, cooking to a certain extent, right? You can fuss around with cooking, you can improvise. But the point being, a lot of what she has to do in life is very, very precise and requires a lot of discipline. And rowing is one of those things. So I think showing it in that kind of like metaphor really, really works. The community aspect of it too, I think you're right. Because you think about it, like she kept getting rejected by the communities that she was trying to enter. The scientific community, not just rejected, like physically forcing her out of things. It's almost like a little bit of a reclamation of who she can be. I guess you and I are in like in a situation where we are collaborative with our colleagues as teachers, where there might be certain objectives that go beyond just the ones in our classroom. And when you have a good team in that regard, you're all working together. That helps. But at the same time, we're all playing to our own strengths too. Right. So we all bring something different to the table. And I've done, you know, team things here and there. Most of my sports experience is either pick up roller hockey as kids or like rec softball. But you still have to like, you know, do those sorts of things. But we've all been also part of that group project that like where there's the dead weight, the person who does everything, that sort of thing too. I think the hurdles people must overcome in order to reach the point where it all feels easy. I think one of them is impatience. Your own impatience because you want to do it. At least that's mine because, and that's just my ADHD talking. But also our society is impatient. Like our society does not value, our society values the hard work put into something when the result is positive, you know?
Yeah.
Or when it's very physically or financially visible, which is why people crap all over the arts half the time because it's like you put a lot of work into a painting that you're just painting because you want to paint it. You're not selling it for thousands of dollars. Like, you know, put a lot of work into writing a short story or a novel that may not be successful. So what's the point of doing it? So like the work is the important thing, the craft, the love of it. But our society does not let us, does not allow for that. Our capitalism does not allow for that. We look upon it as failure if you've complete something but there's no return on your investment beyond your own self-satisfaction.
Yeah.
Again, soapboxing.
Okay,
I said again, soapboxing.
Oh, yes, yeah. Well, you're going to get paid by the minute for these TED Talks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would add, yeah, doing things quickly, you know, to get them done, which I think just overlaps with what you have and not having care attached to it. Again, I'm thinking with about my students at this point, you know, homework assignment, just get it done, but not thinking through it or engaging with it. And then also, what do you do when you come up against a struggle or you have to overcome, you know, a setback? Do you have the grit to do that? Because I think we see this and I have students that like shut down if something doesn't go wrong. Before break, it was one of my students wasn't doing anything. And I thought, you know, I've given you this time to work on your project here. And she said, well, my computer died. And I thought, that's the easiest solution ever. It's like, you can borrow my power cord if you want. So not, you know, if something happens, not thinking like, okay, what can I do to fix this? And I think we see with Elizabeth, like she's really trying hard Yeah, to figure out this rowing thing for Calvin, and she's got to go at it in different ways. And the physics thing worked out for a certain extent, and then it got bad again. So I very much appreciate that. And yeah, I love that this was a piece in the novel, not only because it's a part of the author's life, but we get to see a community, as you said. We get to see this partnership between Calvin and Elizabeth in a different way. And I think you get to see Calvin's heart through this as well. 'Cause some people I think would become impatient or become upset that, you know, it's not working out well. And it's hard to tell what the men in the boat think about Elizabeth, because we only hear things like, if they're not complaining, it's okay, or something like that. Or it might have been the opposite, like if they're yelling, then they're happy. Because when she first came post-pregnancy, everyone was kind of shocked why she was showing up. But I mean, they accept her. It's not like they refuse to go out on the water. So I do appreciate, I think, again, breaking those limits as we talked about in the previous one. And you're right that teaching is a community, your department to a certain extent. But how the school is set up, I was thinking about your particular county and all the things that go into it. But yeah, just the standards that we have for our students and expectations and things like that. If they're not, you know, set well, if we're not adhering to it, or maybe one person is doing this but another person's not, then obviously the community is not going to flourish. So I don't think he's in here, but I was thinking about her brother and her family, because that's actually, I should have added that to the list of traumas that we had. Because her brother, who was gay, killed himself. Her father, because of the father, I would say, the father is like kind of like a snake oil salesman, I guess they would call it, or whatever. Fire and brimstone sort of preacher. He would light people on fire or some such effect in order to, you know, convince them. And one person got badly injured and or died, I am unsure. And then the mother ran away, I think, after everything. So this is kind of the highlights. But she was very close with her brother, so that was a traumatic death for her. And she recounts on two different occasions this, oh, which is actually symbolic about the limits, right? Because they were on a cliff or some sort of rocky
There's like a
outcrop.
quarry. They were at a
Yeah,
quarry.
and he said something about like, I bet you're, you know, too scared to jump, or you won't do that. A limit, right? So she breaks that. So very early on, this is Elizabeth Zott, by jumping in, and she can't swim. And it was also a dangerous jump. And her brother jumps in after her and brings her to the side. And so we heard this earlier on, I think to really just illustrate the love that was between the two of them. But then she's having the same discussion with Wakely, and he's trying to intuit, you know, the meaning of this in a psychological sort of way. And Elizabeth is saying, you don't understand, my brother couldn't swim either. And that moment for me was like, oh my gosh, that's so beautiful, as well as really sad. But yeah, thoughts on her family and that upbringing and her brother.
The brother killing himself because being rejected for being gay tracks with that time,
Yeah.
tracks with several decades over the course of the time, tracks with some type of families. Now we see like outright rejection of people because they come out to their families for being
Yeah.
they're gay or they're non-binary or transgender. They're queer in some way. In fact, my students were talking yesterday about something. We were talking about Romeo and Juliet, and they were saying, "Well, you shouldn't keep secrets from your family," a lot of them were saying. And then a couple of the students who I know are queer are saying, "But you don't know what the secret is, and you don't know how the family acts." And they were like, not they were subtle but not subtle about it, like where it's like, they didn't want to say outright like, what if your family is homophobic and you're gay, like, so you're keeping it for your own safety. And it's really, really a huge tragedy that he did that. But I thought the moment where she revealed that he couldn't swim was beautiful, because it was like, this is, I think she trusted him more than anybody else in the world,
Yeah.
and that's maybe where her erosion of her trust for people. Now, she wasn't betrayed by him, but the whole situation is what started to put her guard up. And it actually makes a lot of sense that she's so engrossed in the scientific side of things, and she's an atheist, that because of who her father was, because her father's very extreme and fundamentalist, right? So there's like an, it's Newton's law, it's an equal and opposite reaction on her part. And I think, was it Wakely who's kind of sits there in the middle, where he can look at science but also have belief and faith?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So, which is interesting, because like that's a perspective that she probably needs, or at least because it's a really interesting conversation for her to have. But yeah, her father being this sort of being the fire and brimstone preacher, it's very Tara Westover in a way. Educated, remember her father was like,
okay.
A,
yeah. I was like, that sounds familiar.
Hopefully yeah, like an educator. Her father was like like basically.
Yep.
Fundamentalist and stuff, and so yeah, and I can picture the father as that sort of revival tent grifter, right? And she's also very, very honest as a person as well. So yeah, I think that's kind of like where I was getting what I was getting.
Yeah. Oh, I can't remember the age gap between the two, but part of me is like, man, if only they could have left together. But that's, if we're talking about the difficulty for a single woman, I can only imagine children trying to survive on their own.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right that it's realistic of the time. Just, yeah, terribly, terribly sad and tragic. And you wonder what it would have been like had she been able to have her brother her whole life. Yeah, all the male. Yeah, I mean, if we're thinking, because there's a question that's on the horizon just about, which I can go into now, about the, a lot of the male characters in her life that are sympathetic to her plight, but very few of them speak up to help her. That's like a transition, because there's definitely a time before where all of the men in her life were not. They were just kind of going, with the exception of her brother, you know, her father and then her advisor, and all of these people just are, I guess, moving through the world as a man with no empathy of women potentially. And then we get to this newer phase of like, oh, she's able to meet some other people. Again, you know, I'm just adding to the trauma thing. It just seems like she's gone through so much, and again, not unrealistic, because there are, you know, people who have experienced that. And she had a foster, was she in a foster home? Is this correct?
I can't remember. So.
Okay. So yeah, she and Calvin had, you know, similarity in that, since he was in an orphanage. So.
He was, John was the name of her brother. It's on page 38. She was 10. He was 17.
Oh, yeah. Oh, so, man, so close. But that's not necessarily, that's us as adults, you know, looking back with kind of an idea of like, this is possible. But that's not something that a 17-year-old would be thinking at the time of like, what if we just ran away, you know, and got out of here?
Yeah.
So, yeah, very sad. Elizabeth is sometimes depressed by the circumstances in her life. I remember again, that balance between humor and gravitas of Mad asking her mother if she's sad. And she's like, no, I'm not sad. And Harriet saying something along the lines of out of the mouths of babes, because, you know, children are able to recognize certain things and also say things very, I don't know, adroitly and observe things that other people cannot. Not coincidentally, her show airs in the quote unquote afternoon depression zone that she's told by Walter, but she's never a victim of this afternoon depression zone. How does she continually pick herself up? What fuels her resilience, and why, after she's reached stardom, is she more miserable than ever?
It's interesting. The afternoon depression zone is like, I think the show airs at like 4:30.
Yeah.
When I was a kid in the 80s, and then you were a kid in the later 80s and early 90s, that would become the Oprah hour.
Oh.
I don't know about where you grew up, but Oprah was on at 4 when I was a kid. Donahue, before that went off, was on competing with her at 4 o'clock. I think Dr. Phil would go on around. So that was the afternoon talk show hour before the news. Now over on the syndicated channels, that was the afternoon cartoon hour. But because that was when G.I. Joe was on, right?
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But yeah, the depression hour, like, yeah, it's just kind of interesting that, like, you know, that has been a time that has been women-centered programming for a long time because of people, you know, would eventually become talk shows and stuff. And these days, I don't even know what's on at 4:30 because maybe judge shows. I don't know. But yeah,
I don't have TV.
Yeah, so I don't watch TV until like 8 o'clock at night. 7:30. I watch Jeopardy every night. I think her daughter motivates her, right? Like she has a mission because she's doing it because she's doing it for somebody else too. So it's interesting that she is depressed, or she's still depressed because, or miserable after reaching the stardom. Because a lot of times when you hear about that, it's because like the person who reached the fame thought they were going to be fulfilled, and then when they turn to like drugs or something, like, you know, it's the kind of, I had a hole to fill it, I didn't, you know, this didn't do it, it's unfulfilling. I don't get that from her. I get that like she's notable in a way she didn't ever expect to be, because she wants to be known as a scientist, and she really appreciates and has love for the work she's doing, because she's obviously doing it to help women. But at the same time, if she were given the Nobel Prize in chemistry or something, she totally would feel more fulfilled, right? So it's like she's doing this in spite of the fact that the scientific career or whatever. And so at the end, you hope that she's on the track to being really fulfilled because she's back at the lab, which is where she wanted to be all along.
Yeah, I don't have much more to add to that. I think Mad is the reason for 90% of it, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
She's able to still do her chemistry through the cooking. So I think that is helpful. And I think she also feels like she owes something to Calvin to a certain extent, whether through Matt or separately. Yeah. And yeah, I think that resilience also, again, breaking those limits, right? I think to a certain extent, maybe subconsciously, she wants to be a positive model for, you know, these housewives and show appreciation that they don't often get, and give them confidence, and also, yeah, I think be truthful in a state of lies, because often, you know, television is lies, you know, that soup, like that sort of thing, trying to protect people. And then, yeah, I think it gets so bad just because, I don't know, she's never respected for or seen as a scientist. And that's the big thing, you know, even the first time we see her in that lab, she was confused for a secretary by Calvin. And so I think just that article that came out was just such a bummer. So I think that was the big thing there.
Yeah.
This is the February episode. And I did mention that family, friendships, and love is very much, for me, at the center of this novel. If we were to talk about the erotic love, were you surprised that the love affair between Calvin and Elizabeth was cut short so suddenly and quickly in the novel? Before page 100, if I'm not incorrect.
I'd forgotten that it was so early too, because Calvin keeps coming up in conversation. Yep. So it's almost like he's there. Maybe I was a little surprised, but the novel was about her being independent, and so we needed to get him out of the picture in some way. Because I think it would have been different had he been there while she was doing this. Because I don't know if it would have happened, right? Like, one of the reasons she gets fired, aside from being pregnant with Calvin's child, it's that Calvin's presence was protecting her from the men at Hastings, right? Like, now that Calvin's gone, we can abuse you all we want. So professionally speaking, like, you know, he's not there to protect you. They wanted him there because he was a very famous chemist. So they're going to placate that him by keeping her around, even though like Donati and those others don't like her and they don't want her there, and to the point where they'll steal her stuff, right? But if she was gone, they wouldn't really give a crap. Yeah, I think, and I don't think having him divorce her would have worked, because that's not Calvin. Like, we know Calvin is like very faithful and loving to her. Like, he is hopelessly to the point where he'll walk the dog. He hates walking the dog, and that's how he dies. That's why she blames herself for it. Maybe a little bit longer could have been, but for the most part, since it is about her making it on her own, they need to get rid of him somehow. And I think it was a good way of doing it, because it provided a lot of complexity to her grief with Calvin, etc.
yeah. So for plot purposes, you are correct, because otherwise there's no way that you would have had that show.
Yeah.
It would have been a completely different novel, and it would have just, yeah, been, I guess, how she got recognized with abiogenesis or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the first time I read it, I was quite shocked at what happened. And I will say, I don't think he had a problem with walking, that it was the leash.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted 630 to be leashless, and felt, you know, everyone who wants to have a leash on them. It's true, metaphorically and literally. But yeah, it's like they barely begun. You know, they meet. That was a bit awkward. He throws up on her. That was a bit awkward. And, you know, then they're eating lunch, and they're the gossip of the lab, for whatever reason. People need to get their own, stay their own business. I guess that's the version of reality television. I guess that was the 50s and 60s version, because, you know, people were just enjoying other people's drama.
Yeah.
And then they're living, and he's got the money, so he pays for the house, and she does, you know, pays by food, basically, because she doesn't have a good living wage. I don't even know if she has a living wage, to be honest. And yeah, it's just great. It's a nice, like, slow development, so you expect it to be long lasting, and then to have that ripped out from under you is quite the shock the first time that you read it, for sure. But you're right that it would have been a completely different novel if he had been there. But he does, I mean, he's still there. You're right that you know, in your I guess forgetting that it happened so soon, because his name is everywhere. Anytime someone mentions that Jack person who does the fitness, you know, Calvin is there. Matt asks questions. Wakely, the whole investigation with the boys home, you know, Calvin is a constant presence in this novel.
Yeah. Jack LaLanne, by the way, it was an actual person. He was
was or was not?
Was. Oh. Yeah, he had a workout program. He was like one of the very earliest TV fitness celebrities. So he would do those, you know, those workout shows that I don't know if they air very much anymore nowadays. They sell like DVDs, tapes, or they're on YouTube. But that format of like, okay, we're going to work out together today. Jack LaLanne like pioneered that back in the 50s and 60s.
I see.
Yeah.
The 50s and 60s version of Richard Simmons?
No, LaLanne was a lot more serious.
Oh, okay.
Straightforward. He was kind of like not muscle man in the way that like Schwarzenegger was back in the 70s and 80s, but like definitely that sort of, you know, muscular man who was going to be like, I'm going to get you into shape. So think more about like Billy Blanks doing Tai Bo.
Oh,
or some of the other, or just some of the people you see on a YouTube who is either, they might be doing workouts or yoga or something, and they're very like friendly, but their teacher, like Simmons was great, but Simmons had that personality that was like flamboyant in his own way. And that's not what LaLanne was like.
Lovely. Thoughts on the boys' home drama, I don't even know what to call it, side story, and the Avery Park, like how everything ended up. Do you think that it was too neat? Was it an interesting side? I was going to say side mission, as if you're a gamer. Side mystery, and then with a nice wrap up at the end. What are your thoughts on that? Calvin's history, basically.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, maybe it was a little too neatly wrapped up with Avery Parker, but Avery Parker was like rich enough to be able to access that level of information, whereas like a middle-class person would be more easily shut out by those who were keeping the information secret. It does speak to the fact that that system has been corrupt for decades in some way or another. Not all the foster system, the adoption care and orphanage system is corrupt, but there's certainly a lot of it. And the 50s are no exception. It does provide a counterpoint to, in the modern sense, in the contemporary to this novel sense of the novel's present day, Wakely, who is a person of God who is very well rounded and like actually a very, very good example, right? Because he listens to her, he develops a friendship with the kid. His beliefs are complex as opposed to her father, who was, you know, extreme in his beliefs and then was really out for money. So the corruption there. And then there's the Catholic Church in that case, that in its 2000 something years of existence has never done anything untoward toward anybody, and they've never been controversial and they've never done anything wrong. But the idea that there was this kind of like shady bishop who was like, I'm gonna swipe the money and tell these people, like, I can totally see that happening because they feel like they can manipulate the people and the families around them. So I get it. Did they spend a little too much time on it? Sometimes I think yes, but at the same time, it's Mad's storyline. It's not Elizabeth's. Like, Elizabeth wants to know some things, so she kind of, and we kind of need that because Elizabeth was looking into some things, etc. But it's really more Mad's plot where she's trying to, she starts to stumble on things and she's a curious kid and she wants to solve this mystery and what's his name is going to help her.
Wakely,
thank you. So I think that makes it more necessary than had it been just another thing that Elizabeth was looking into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I won't call it a deficiency, but I was trying to figure out, I was hoping that maybe the bishop was, I was misunderstanding what was happening, but he really is, unfortunately. I guess the reason why is because no one's reacting to it negatively. Mm-hmm. So I was thrown off by that, because even his secretary is not batting an eye that he's basically telling her to lie. So I guess I was like, is there something else going on here? But I just had to be like, Stella, wake up. It's just, he's a bad guy. There are bad guys everywhere, even in the church. We know that if that's true. So I just had to wake up. And then later on, because he's always in trouble. And I did feel bad because, you know, you and I know that both for good reason as well as biased reason, I should say for true reasons, maybe that's not even the right word, but there's some bias involved, as well as, you know, there are things that should be handled that often boy students get in trouble more than female students. So again, sometimes there is bias and sometimes they should get in trouble. But here, you know, that bishop was saying, there's that one scene where he says, well, you know, I'm going to rank my like least favorite or the most troublesome students in my head. I don't know what he is. I was like, what? And Calvin is always at the top, which is really sad. And I thought, well, maybe he just has like a lot of energy, you know, and his pages were ripped out. So I was trying to sort through everything, but then the journals were found and it seemed like he might have experienced abuse in that home. I don't know what kind. I think perhaps it doesn't matter. And the subtle hinting, I think, was enough. I think, you know, you mentioned at the top of this time that, we both have opinions about sexual assault and its representation and its appearance in novels. And I think that Garmus also recognized that, because one was enough. It was like 1.5 because we were on the precipice of another one.
Yeah.
But we have other mentionings, and I think having that off page and just having it insinuated was quite enough for this. I'm trying to think of what. Oh, yeah. So it kept coming in so we can get to learn more about Calvin, which, again, I think goes back to our other point that Calvin is taken so soon from the novel, but he's still everywhere. So we get to know more. You're right that it's Mad storyline. And I think it pulls in Wakely, and it has this nice contrast between this terrible bishop and this man who recognizes, you know, how humanity has fallen and the terribleness of people, and also has this love of science and has to reconcile a lot of things, but is a trustworthy guy. And then at the end, you know, with Avery, it did feel like a little too neat, but because all of this had been like dotted everywhere, I think it did need to have some sort of climax for that storyline alone, which I guess is the climax potentially of the whole novel, and just everything coming together. Because even the funds that were coming in, like that was going back, you know, from Avery, and to know, it's just sad that Calvin was dead because
they lied to the parents.
Yeah, and he hated the executor of you know, the man who came, and just to know that he actually was loved, that's like the saddest part, is just he died there. But at least, you know, now Elizabeth has that knowledge and Matt has it, and they have a family. I think they've already, there was another question about family and what is the definition of that. And mm-hmm. I think this novel shows so many avenues of what family is, because it, you know, very literally you have Mad and Elizabeth and you know, that, if that's your definition of it, but Harriet comes in and becomes just this wonderful, beautiful friend. And oh my gosh, someone who's coming over at 4:30 in the morning. That was one of those funny things of, you know, like who's going to come over here and watch Matt, and Harriet's like, I'll do, you know, it's just so hilarious, that exchange. Cause she probably, I think she wants to be wanted. There's that whole like, will she, won't she call me? Because she's looking across the street through her window, hoping for Elizabeth to call her for help. That was just so amazing. So there's that addition, Walter being added there. You've got 6:30. Wakely becomes a part of that. And then you have this. Yeah. So it's just this beautiful expansion of family to have as an ending for Elizabeth, who lost everyone and really lost her brother, who was the core of her family and had no one on her side. That's like the beauty of the arc of this whole book for me. Just wonderful.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I didn't mind if the Avery thing was wrapped up in a little bit of a bow, because I wanted this book to have a happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm just like really, really wanted that to happen. So we can kind of nitpick it all we want, but at the end of the day, I was so happy that happened.
Absolutely. The family tree episode. So I have kind of a teacher question for you.
Mm-hmm.
And then the idea is that Madeline, who has probably a pretty awesome / wackadoodle looking family tree, I would love to see an image of it, because there's like an acorn that says the fairy godmother. There are all these things.
Yeah.
She also has Sojourner Truth on there, Amelia Earhart, and Nefertiti, just to show that all humans are related, which I think is amazing. My teacher question is, what do you think of family tree assignments? Do you think that those are things that should not exist? And then what do you think we can learn from Mad's interpretation of this assignment?
I actually had to do the family tree assignment in seventh grade, which is how I started tracing my family back. And I realized that my great uncle Ray had traced our family back to like the 1800s in England, my mom's side of the family. And it was valuable to me, but as I said, continuously, I was saying this in last episode, I'll say now, it's like, I was in a very privileged white middle-class community where divorce was not as common. People didn't have really, really awful things in their background, or some people did, but a lot of people didn't. So it wasn't really looked upon in 1989 when I did it as controversial in any way. These days, I'm like, I see why people are like, don't do that anymore, because it can be considered very insensitive to children or teenagers, whoever, who don't have a family, or they don't connect, or there's something really bad. Like it can be triggering in ways. And I know there are people in the world who'd be like, well, we can't do this anymore. And they get frustrated. The conflict for me comes in the fact that I love genealogical research. And I think it's a really valuable thing to teach, that like kids can look back and find the people who like are their ancestors or where they come from, and learn about the places they were and the history behind the family. I think 99.9% of people's family history is just tends to be very ordinary anyway. No offense to those people, but not everybody's related to George Washington. You know, it's just like, okay, you know, my great-grandparents came over on a boat, you know, and that's that whole thing. And so I think there's some real value, especially if you're studying like American history and stuff, but it's a very, very sensitive area, and it's a minefield. So that's why I wouldn't teach it or wouldn't do that sort of project, which does frustrate me, because I would love to talk about like, how do you do this research and how do you verify that? To use my great grandfather's name, this Joseph Panarese is the Joseph Panarese, and not another Giuseppe or Joe, you know, like those sorts of things. And I think it's a really valuable research and critical thinking tool that gets lost because of the cultural and political implications surrounding it, which are very founded. That's a long-winded way of saying, no, I wouldn't teach it, but yeah, I do see some value in it.
Yeah, I don't know who still does it because it does seem to be a lower school sort of thing. But
yeah.
Even, you know, we are instructed, which I mess up frequently, instructed to use caregivers rather than parents, you know. I tend to, if I send emails out to a group of my students and their caregivers, all instead of normally I would say salvate parentes, but I'll say salvate omnes, you know, to have that. And I think, yeah, it does unfortunately highlight potentially trauma in the family, or, you know, having lost somebody, or, you know, you just don't know. But I think, yeah, I think there are other ways to potentially investigate origin stories in a thoughtful way. And for Mad, I really appreciate that the people that she has chosen, because we have they're multinational, multiracial, multicultural.
Yeah.
That, you know, people are practically the same. I think this thing is that humans are 99.9% the same. You know, it's just about how we, I think, carry ourselves and our character rather than, you know, these external features that we're so focused on. And so again, yeah, just as Harriet said, from the mouths of babes, so I think Mad is able to teach us much, teach humanity much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love her character. She gets a little annoying at points, but like, I do love her character.
Yeah.
She's just like I said, it's hard to write a precocious character of a precocious child and make them charming.
Oh, yes.
And she does it really, really well.
I did worry though. I was thinking, man, if this lie that she's 1 year older will go on forever, will this ever be something that she'll want to go back and change the birth certificate? I was thinking about that this time. I don't think I have any other questions. Is there anything that you wanted to look at?
No, I think we really covered just about everything.
Okay. Lovely.
Yeah.
So then, Tom, we have the last question, which is this book, Lessons in Chemistry, required reading?
Yes.
Whoa, Tom, I would big say words. Yes.
It's, okay. No, yeah, it's a great, it's literary rich, but it's not overly pretentious, and it's fun to read, and it's got great, pun intended, lessons in it, but the characters are wonderful. Yeah, it's a great, great book, and I really think people should read it.
Yeah, 100%. We've talked about themes, character arcs, writing styles. I think it could be great as a creative writing tool. And yeah, we didn't talk about shifting perspectives, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. You mentioned it in your intro. And oh, the times, you know, a snapshot of the times and looking at it through a critical lens, as well as bringing up current and relevant events that are happening now. So yeah, absolutely.
Cool. We do have a little bit of feedback, so I'm going to go ahead and get into that. We have a bunch of Facebook comments from our Scholastic book buddy, Robert Ward, talking about Good Spirits, which was episode 109. He says, Stella's question immediately made me think of one thing, man of ectoplasm, woman of Kleenex. She's like, and her response was, poor Lois. But it was Tom who was wondering, so thank you.
Tom was the one wondering about the sexy time with.
Yeah, he also says that a podcast he listened to tries to do an annual holiday smut. And last year's was a very fun listen. It looks like the Overdue podcast, it's called. He says, I recommend giving it a listen if you want more holiday-themed smut. And it looked like...
Kidnapped by the Krampus?
Yes.
That sounds like... Kidnapped
by
the Krampus
by Emily Shore.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I was telling Tom, I don't think on air, but I did talk to Tom about a book that I had found after we had recorded where it's a why choose, and it's a woman with three reindeer shifters. And there was nodding involved, so I should have chosen that, but I chose well with what we had. I don't need to. Poor Tom is innocent, you know.
That, in the words of the iconic Britney Spears, I'm not that innocent.
Ooh.
So
yeah,
from episode 110, he does say that your number one choice on that list, which I believe was Jane Eyre, it was definitely not surprising, as I had no idea of if they would be unique choices or books that have been brought up before. The love for her is so well known that you can't be angry. And then he has a random question for us. Have either of us done a long-term reading project before? I discovered a subreddit for reading Count of Monte Cristo throughout the year, and I'm reading along. I've known the story and had an audiobook for years, but excited to finally read it. Monte Cristo's on my list. I just haven't gotten around to it. I'm going to start with you. What do you...
Yeah, you know, this is going to sound silly. I'm super confused why Monte Cristo seems to be really long. Like, it's being mentioned now. I've seen it on Instagram, you know, people kind of moving through it. I read it. I didn't think it was that long. Maybe I was just so engaged that it didn't seem so long. So I'm just so confused. It must be longer than I imagined it, which is great for the story. Yeah, my big one would be the Bible. Reading the Bible in the year. It's difficult to do. So that would be the one. I myself have only done it once. Okay. So you can imagine, but it's very specific in what you do. It's usually you read something from, you know, Old Testament and pair it with a Psalm, and then you have something going on in the New Testament as well. So you're reading at least four chapters a day. That is sort of spanning, but that would be the only project that I would have. Yeah.
I've heard this done for like James Joyce and like Ulysses and novels like that, right? But I abandoned reading that. the only thing I can think of is if there's like a very long running book series and you're trying to read your way through several of the novels over a long period of time. Like I am kind of doing a read / watch through of Star Wars from The Phantom Menace all the way to The Rise of Skywalker. Selectively reading. I'm not reading every single novel that was out there in the older new EU. So I'm just kind of picking what I want to do. And so that's a reading project that has an architecture plan to it. The only one that I can think of just is in the realm of like comic books. I've had a reading project a few years ago where I read the entire Chris Claremont X-Men run.
Whoa.
Yeah. Well, I had the essential volumes up until the end of Inferno. And then at the time I had a Marvel Unlimited subscription. So I just picked up where Inferno left off and took it all the way to where the end of his run was.
Yeah.
But that's like, what, 16 years worth of...
That's a lot, yeah.
Worth of comic books. Well, I started with Giant Size X-Men, number one, which was a Len Wein book. But you know, basically, it's like 16 years or 18 years worth of books. So that was a lot of stuff, but I had all the stuff. So there's like, we've both done you've been doing a prolonged reading project involving Barbara Gordon for the last 67 years. So yeah. In the realm of comic books, yes. Because there are like long, you could read like all the Lee Kirby Fantastic Four or Amazing Spider-Man from the beginning. You can read, I've read the New Teen Titans from the beginning all the way through to the end of the New Titans series a couple of times over. You can do a long reading project of certain crossovers. So there's a lot of long-term reading projects that I've done and you've probably done, and maybe it's the comic readers out there who listen to us have done using comic books. That's probably where I default to in terms of reading projects.
Yeah.
All right. So we are done.
I can't believe it.
I know.
So you know what that means?
What does that mean?
We're taking a year off.
Yeah, right.
Tom, what is next up on Required Reading?
Stella. I think it's just kind of funny because I think this is very similar to what we did last March and I didn't realize it until I was flipping through some stuff. I think we need to go back to Panem and I think we need to read Catching Fire.
Okay.
You ready for that?
Yes.
All right.
Cool. I was, as you were speaking, I was trying to figure out which ones we hadn't done.
Yeah, we haven't done Catching Fire. We haven't done Mockingjay.
Okay.
So we're going to get one step closer to finish. Speaking of book series, we're going to get one step closer to finishing our look at the Hunger Games, even though we did it completely out of order, with Catching Fire, which is the second of the original Hunger Games trilogy. So check that out when we come back in a month. And until then, thank you very much for listening and take care.
And remember, CH3COOH, that's vinegar.
Good night.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by Two True Freaks. That's Two True Freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/requiredreadingwithtomandstella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.